I'm Jason Michael Perry, the man with three first names, and this is a special episode of Thoughts on Tech and Things. Every quarter, I host an in-depth panel conversation as part of the World Trade Center Institute's Agile Speaker Series. We return to the Johns Hopkins Carey School of Business for our recent talk, where we tackle deepfakes in cybersecurity. If AI can fake your voice, if it can fake your face, if it can fake your writing style, or if it can even impersonate you, how does cybersecurity adapt and how do we protect ourselves? To get into this, I'm joined by an amazing panel, including two return podcast guests, Tina Williams-Caroma, who you might remember from our episode on whether hackers hack computers or if they hack people, Joe Binge, who was on our very first episode where we asked the question, what is a photo? And also a new voice on the show, Dr. Yolanda Reed. As always, links are in the show notes, and I want to give a very special thanks to the amazing team at the World Trade Center Institute for putting this event on. Also, WIPR and our producer, Sam Burmes-Dawes and Shania Mapson. I also want to thank Perry Labs, head of operations and marketing, Myrna Martinez. Now, let's get into it, and I hope you enjoy.
I'm excited for the session that we're going to talk about today. For those of you I have not met, my name is Eddie Resende, and I'm the CEO of the World Trade Center Institute, the host of the Agile series. As a little bit of a background, we launched this series about a decade ago, and the goal was always to, how do we address topics that are top of mind to global CEOs when it comes to innovation? Over the years, we've addressed a lot of different topics. This year, or last year alone, we looked into data centers. We talked about AI. We looked at managing crises that are caused by natural disasters and emergencies. And today, we're going to learn about cybersecurity. And we have an amazing panelist, which I will introduce my colleague in just a second. I want to recognize and actually first thank all of our sponsors. Without you, it wouldn't be possible. So thank you to TEDCO, Rupert International, also Collins Aerospace. I think we have a few people from Collins here. And of course, our co-host of the series, Carey Business School, that's been an amazing partner for us, providing this beautiful space for us to meet this morning. I want to also recognize, I think we have three WTCI board members in the audience. There's Dan from T. Rowe Price over here. We have Tom Rignante from Chase, and Joel from Air St. Gross is here with us today as well. Welcome. Glad you're able to make it. And Corinne, if I could ask you to come up here and just say a few things on behalf of the Carey Business School, and thank you again for your partnership, and before I introduce Jason.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. My name is Corinne Brassfield. I'm the Director of Strategic Partnerships and Student Innovations here at the Carey Business School. Very happy to welcome this great crowd on a beautiful morning that is hopefully warmer than it has been. But we're excited for this panel, this really interesting topic, and Carey Business School is just really excited to be a partner in the local Baltimore community to all of our employer partners. We are a source of talent, a source of talent development. Please speak to myself or my colleague Victoria. We're in the room today. We would love to further our relationship with other local organizations and tell you more about our corporate partnership plan and our amazing student talent that we have here in all of our master's and MBA programs. So again, thank you so much for being here. Welcome, and I'll turn it back to Eddie. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Corinne. How about a round of applause for Corinne and the JHU team here today? Thank you. So I'm going to pass it over to Jason Michael Perry, who is a moderator for the session today. Jason is a longtime friend, and he is a subject matter expert on, I consider, all things technology, especially AI. He has his own show on WIPR. And a couple of years ago, I got together with Jason, and I said, hey, we're looking for someone to come on board at WTCI as a senior advisor of corporate innovation and technology. Help us as an organization to become better users of the latest and greatest technology, but also lead these forums where we can bring people together and create a platform that we can address these topics. So Jason's been an amazing partner for us. In the spirit of Bad Bunny, he has agreed to do this all in Spanish today for all of you guys. But Jason, take it over. Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie. I can't believe it's been a few years.
So how's everybody doing?
So today's session started off with a question that I asked in the newsletter, and then on the first episode of the podcast, Thoughts on Tech and Things with WIPR. And it's a very simple question, or it seems like a very simple question. What is a photo, right? And if you think about photos that you have probably taken with your phone, here's an interesting thing. Google nor Apple consider the thing that you take with your phone to be a photo because it's so digitally altered. It's not a photograph as we think about it. And AI is making this even more interesting because AI is starting to kind of blend this question of what is reality and what's not. So there's this tool that OpenAI released called Sora. It lets you create videos, and you can upload your pictures and then create whatever videos you want. So for my birthday last year, I sent a whole bunch of folks this video. I know Michelle posted it on social media for promoting this event, of me with Mark Cuban, Sam Altman, having margaritas on the beach. And then after having margaritas, we did a push-up contest. It wasn't really me, right? This is all generated. But it's getting harder and harder and harder to tell what is real and what's not real. And that has real impacts on cybersecurity, as we're going to talk about in a lot of detail today. But it continuously brings up this question of what's real. Now, 3-4 years ago, every time someone would post a video or a photo that was AI generated, everyone would like, look at the hands, right? You can see the fingers are weird or things are strange. But as I have consistently said over and over again, today's AI is the worst AI you ever use. And this tech is getting better and better and better. And so while some of these artifacts that you see now may make it easier to see, it's going to get harder and harder and harder. And this, again, has some real-world ramifications for how we think about security. And with that, I think it's perfect time to introduce my panel. We have Tina Williams-Caroma. Tina was just recently on my podcast. It was a great episode about cybersecurity, so I recommend listening to it after this. Now, Tina is a serial entrepreneur and a cybersecurity expert. She's the founder and CEO of T-Secure, a Maryland-based cybersecurity risk management firm, and SciDeploy, an AI-driven platform that tests the impact of security changes before deployment. She holds degrees in computer science, management, law, and brings more than 2 decades of experience bridging technology, business, and governance strategy to advance resilient cybersecurity solutions and leadership. Thank you, Tina. You guys picked the same order on my list. It's perfect. All right. We have Joe Binge. Joe, who's also a friend, was the person who I interviewed for our first episode of the Thoughts on Tech and Things podcast. It was actually our pilot episode on that topic I talked about, what is a photo? And so he and I have talked a lot about what a photo is. Now, Joe has worked with companies from NASA to Nickelodeon, along with several other organizations that start with the different letters that have N in them. You can make a guess there. He started as an actor and a video game tester. He became an IT specialist doing help desk and systems engineering and policy work. After joining the government, he became the principal cybersecurity communications manager at the headquarters level. His latest book, which is very good, Be a Nerd That Talks Good, is quickly becoming a go-to guide for tech founders, researchers, and other nerds in turning their technical knowledge into powerful messages. Thank you, Joe. And we have Yolanda Reed. Dr. Reed is a cybersecurity and technology executive with over 2 decades advancing innovation and national security in emerging technologies. She served in the Department of Defense and held executive positions in industries at IBM and Raytheon, driving cyber operations, AI, quantum initiatives. She's also a proud cancer survivor, a mentor, a cheer mom, and that inspires others through resilience. Preservation and service. Goodness gracious. All right.
You can just regenerate this dialogue afterwards.
That's exactly what my plan is after this. So we all just took this test, and we're all experiencing this same thing. What is real? And it's kind of getting to this point where you have to kind of second-guess things when you look at what's happening. So I'm just curious to just start off, how is your relationship with what's real or what's true change over the last few years, especially with AI?
I can start. Okay. So this just happened like 2 weeks ago, and I think I'm doing pretty good. I have a teenage daughter in high school, And she was talking to me, and she goes, "Mom, you know, my friends all watch totally fake videos, and they don't even know it's fake videos." I'm like, "Oh, I'm teaching her good." And then she's like, she has a process that she's trying to implement of whether to determine if it's true or not, which I was also very proud that she said this. And so I think critical thinking is becoming very real, right? And so she was thinking through, like, why was this video created? What's the emotion they wanted? Who benefits from it? And she was doing that on her own. And I think that is being more responsible with the content that is being put out there. So that's how my household is handling the fakeness. And I'm glad she articulated it just a couple weeks ago.
I love that. And I think, Tina, when we were talking in our pre-conversation about this, you mentioned this idea of having a defensive framework. Like, you know, and I think, Yolanda, just like the idea of stop, drop, and roll kind of, you know, idea of what you should do when you're looking at content to tell reality.
Yeah, so I'd done a recent talk with the National Cryptological Foundation. They had it at the TAC in Columbia, and it was focused on parents and how parents could better equip their kids to be responsible digital citizens, right? And so, like, the talk was really centered on what I framed as, like, a discern model, like, you know, helping kids to ask the right question, similar to what Yolanda said her daughter was doing, right? Like, so, but it's not enough just to have them be able to see when something is off or wrong. They need to be equipped with how to react once they see something that's off or wrong. So just questions around, can I validate this with a known trusted source offline first, right? Like, so looking at that is like one question. Asking the question, is this something that somebody loves me or a friend would, you know, repost or ask of me, you know, so kind of going through those sorts of questions, right, in their mind. And while it was certainly a model for children, unfortunately, you all are smiling, right? Adults need the same discern model. And a lot of it really is around kind of slowing down. I think it's very similar to DHS, I think, that had put together the Stop, Think, Connect campaign, right? Like, just stop for a moment, you know, and all of us are just like, yeah, sure, click, you know. And so I think that that's a part of the conversation, and we'll certainly unwrap it a bit more as it pertains to business.
Yeah. One of my favorite things when I interviewed you last time is I said, trust but verify, and you're like, no. No, don't even start with the trust. Right. Hey, verify first. Right. Okay.
Yes. I'll echo the Stop, Think, Connect as someone who was at the department when we launched that. I was not in that group, and it was a different era, we'll just say that. Being now kind of on the outside and helping a lot of companies develop their content and develop their messaging, you know, we also have to be mindful that we don't jump on trends and we don't jump on the emotions. So what I do is I caution a lot of my clients into really planning and thinking, stopping before we develop content, before we put things out there, and think through the ramifications of what we're doing, because we can, you know, make the noise louder, we can contribute to the slop and the mess that's out there, or we can, if we are acting in the best interests of our organizations and the people that we serve, we need to make sure that we are not contributing and jumping on and doing that. So, you know, I think I'm kind of from, yes, I've got a teenager as well, so understanding how people consume media, but also understanding how organizations create media is crucial in that media literacy.
And I'll give it right back to you in a second. But we talked about us, and we talked about the children. But our seasoned saints, I will call them, they are also contributing. They're like, you know, they're having a very hard time with seeing these videos and then getting angry. And I'm telling them, like, oh, that's probably fake. That's probably a bot. And they're like, why would someone create that? I'm like, they probably didn't. A bot probably created it too. And they're sharing, and they're participating in that too, and not realizing they're part of the problem as well. So is a conversation that we all should have at different levels. Like, I think parents can work with kids to help them to think, because we have more experience to be able to work through more scenarios with them, but then also the aging generation, they need help too, because this is completely different from what they've seen in the last 50, 60, 70 plus years.
That's, I think, a perfect for the next stage of the conversation, because I think that's the thing that maybe we forget, is that this is an attack vector, as they call it. This is a way that you can be manipulated into doing things. And you may think of this as, oh, it's just an innocent thing that I looked at a video that was fake. But I don't know if many of us realize that there are organizations that have people whose full-time jobs are to try and spam and fish and trick you into doing something unexpectedly. It's a big thing. And so one of the things I constantly talk about is that there are risks here, right? There are ramifications. And I'm hoping that maybe you all can help us set the stage of understanding what types of risks there are and being tricked, but also the types of, what are these attack vectors, if somebody wants to explain what that is?
I can start. So I think when we think about a threat or a risk, we don't always consider the value of being ourselves. You just being you, you have access to certain things, you're able to open certain doors, get in certain rooms digitally or otherwise, just by being you. You're able to access certain credit, you're able to make certain approvals, yes or no, falls on you. So I think it's important to think through, if someone were to be able to impersonate me, be me, what kind of door and access does that open, right? Like, if you consider, okay, if I tell an employee to do X, because I am me, they are likely to do X, whatever it is that I say, right? If it's my account that can get access to these files and this information, if somebody has access to or through my account, they also have access to those files. So I think that that's an important just kind of mental paradigm to put yourself in, is to consider, if somebody is able to be me, what does that mean they can do? What kind of power or authority do they have? And I think that that's a big part of the attack vector. Even if you think about a decision, if somebody can influence you to decide A or B, what kind of power and influence comes with you, in particular, having a certain mindset or making a certain decision? And I think that that starts to unwrap and reveal how nefarious the threat can be and why it is so attractive and such big business influence, for faking things, for attempting to access identity. There's a lot around identity, just by you being you. So that's how I would frame the conversation initially.
Just to frame it so you can mentally see it. You can imagine that there is a group of folks sitting in something like a giant call center, and their job, 9 to 5 every day, is to go and try and get access to your information. And figure out ways to do it. And this is not make believe. This is a literal thing. There are people whose jobs are doing this.
And it's profitable. It's very profitable, and unfortunately. And you know, I have to verify. So I'm going to put something out there that I haven't verified through trusted sources. But there are reports out there that says, if you look at the world economy, that just the money made from identity theft could be considered, if it was a country, could be considered the fourth richest country of the world. And so it's very, very profitable to steal your identity and to get out there. And from a hacking perspective, right, if we were just to think of a traditional hacker, and I say it that way because now technology is more hacking than people are hacking. But if you were to look at a traditional hacker, they can try to go after you, or they can try to go after someone who doesn't value their identity and their credentials to get to you. and whatever's the fastest path they will take. So it was very profitable to find someone to say, oh, no one cares about me, and to exploit them to get to what you want. So I think it was a very good point for you to say, you know, own your identity, and your identity is very, very valuable.
If we could put some words to that, some additional words to that, Yolanda, and I think it's exactly what you said. Hackers, like I always say this, we imagine these folks on computers, but it's a lot of times these are hacking you. There's a word for this. It's social engineering, right? Mm-hmm. And social engineering is how do I have a conversation with you to get somewhere? And the thing that I find that's so fascinating about social engineering is that self-value thing that I think both of you said, because the easiest way to entry is not usually the thing that you think. Correct. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and especially, you know, we're here to talk about deep fakes and technology. This is really not a technology problem. Even as much as the nerds would love this to be, it continues to be a human problem and a trust problem. And, you know, you've mentioned that, you know, the trust but verify. And, you know, it sounds very cynical, but in cybersecurity from a technology standpoint, we have this concept of zero trust, which I hope we'll be talking about, which is, you know, approach every interaction from a standpoint of suspicion, not suspicion. It's the I don't trust this until I verify that this is a valuable trustworthy transaction to go down, right? From a technology standpoint, that sounds great, right? We can build all these tools. We can have all this big industry that comes up around making sure that transactions digitally take place on a trusted basis. From a human standpoint, that's very, very difficult. Because as humans, we want to trust, right? We want to trust the people that we know. You know, I put this scarf on because I met the ladies in the back and they both had scarves on. And I said, I want to be part of the group, right? I unfortunately couldn't keep it because it was very hot up here. But, you know, I wanted to be part of the group. And that's what we do as human beings. So when someone starts to build a relationship, and they do, even from a digital standpoint, even the bots try to leverage that trust, and they try to do this trust transference, right? So that we drop our guard. And so from a human standpoint, we need to find a way of balancing out that we don't want to all be, pardon my French, a-holes with every single interaction. Like, oh yeah, well, prove it to me. Show me your ID, right? We don't want to be antagonistic, but we also need to find a way of making it okay when the stakes are high. And that means understanding the stakes and understanding what we control or what we provide access to, of making it easier to establish that trust. And this just makes it harder, you know. The technology does make it harder.
And technology makes trust harder, but what technology has changed is it's made it easier to deceive, because the barriers to entry are getting tougher. Before, we talked about someone photoshopping a document or photoshopping an image, and that required a level of knowledge and expertise that AI doesn't. But we could take that a step further, right? I'm sure all of you have been through some form of phishing, smishing, you know, training on security and best practices that tells you, you know, not to trust emails, right? But what's emerging in this world of AI, it's this idea of vibe everything. So just like we have vibe coders, we also have vibe hackers. And vibe hackers and vibe coders mean that the barriers to entry, when we're talking about trust, are much lower than they have been before. I don't know if any of you could talk about this vibe hacking phenomenon.
Well, I think just in touching on it, it is like when you think about, how many of you like Mr. Robot, right? Like that was like fun, like, right, yeah, hands, like brilliant guy, right? Like I think that kind of frames our notion of the kind of smarts and, you know, wit and capability that we think is required to be an effective hacker. But especially with the advent of AI, there was already some of it even without AI, because there's an entire marketplace of, you know, selling successful exploits that some, you know, nefarious Mr. Robot already created, right? So it's been some time since you've necessarily had to be the genius, you know, yourself if you were an adversarial hacker. But now you don't even have to like necessarily wait to purchase something that a genius hacker did create. You can just vibe it yourself, right? And so, you know, a lot of times when we think about the utility of AI from a defense perspective, like, oh, look, like we can use AI to speed up our ability to detect particular attackers and things like that. It's almost a zero-sum game because on the other side of it is AI being used to speed up the ability to create exploits and to deliver those exploits in a very smart and targeted way. So, you know, whereas AI, yes, is being talked about and used a lot for cybersecurity, it's also being used on the opposite side for attacks. One thing I do want to also say, just to kind of connect the prior conversation with this one, is around while AI is certainly making it more difficult to tell what's true and what's false, the other thing that's making it easier are some things that are in our hands to control, and that is the data that we just voluntarily share. So again, I'll bring it back to like with children, one of the things, it wasn't just about what children can, parents can help their children to do to protect themselves, but it's also what parents need to do. And you guys have probably seen, you know, the happy mom or dad that had, you know, their newborn, and it's like, you know, Christopher Michael Smith, you know, it's like you got first name, middle name, last name, you've got date of birth, you probably got mom's maiden name in parentheses, you know, so that everybody can track her. You got the city and state of birth. And I mean, like, hackers are pretty patient. They'll wait, you know, a few years until like that information about a newborn is very valuable. But, you know, like that is information volunteered, right? That can be used nefariously in the background, but it also is something that provides a baseline of trust. Like if somebody comes up to your child and says, yeah, remember, like I'm your mom's friend. I went to your baseball game that you had last night and we were really celebrating. Yeah, she said she's going to be, you know, late at work, you know, at Lockheed, you know, where she is. So she told me to, you know, come in and pick you up. We'll make sure to get your favorite food on the way there, and then we'll take you home. I mean, that kind of thing is really, really hard for a kid, right? Like to like, oh, but they have so much information. Like the worst lie is 99% true, right? Like that's the challenge, right? And so you take both that additional, like the facts that somebody has about you or, you know, your child or your business or whatever, and you combine that then with AI. And that's what, you know, hackers, like the vibe part is certainly around the technology, but it's easier to leverage the technology in an effective way when it's informed by this whole onslaught of facts, you know, to present with it. So I would just say that that's what adversaries are working with and why they're able to be extremely successful.
Go ahead, Yolanda.
Yeah, there's so much in there. I'm like taking mental notes like, oh, I want this, I want that. But technology makes it easier. And we're hitting this point of technology versus technology, right? And you were talking about the good versus evil. And I see like, evil got a jump start and they're like rapidly going faster. And then the good guys are still like, oh, we kind of think that evil's happening and they're not working as aggressively. And so those are the things that kind of keep me up at night is that I know if, you know, in my previous life, if I had the tools that I could have now, I know what I would have done. And so, I think that, we need to have more conversations and start thinking on the good side. Creatively, how can the data that we have, how can we protect the data? Does all the data need to be accessed? We need to think through that. And then how can this data be used against us and plan for that a lot better is one thing. The second part that I wanted to say is while technology is accelerating, these are all old cybersecurity practices. It's just with new tools. And so I'll tell you a short story, you know, going back to social engineering. I had an aunt who gave me a lot of information at a family gathering, and she worked for a chief of police in a very large metropolitan area. And I somehow was working in that area, and I drove by, and I'm like, hey, my aunt works in that building. I wonder if I could go visit her. And I used all of the information that she told me at a family gathering, you know, months ago, and with her story to actually get in there. And I got all the way up to the chief of police office because she supported him. And how did I do that? I was like, oh, I want to surprise her. I brought in flowers. They were like, oh, you're such a good niece. Mm-hmm. And all of those things. And I knew what floor she worked on because I remember her telling me, you know, when I go to the building, I push this number, everybody goes, ooh, you work for the chief. And so all of those things, the 99%, right? All of those things are old concepts, social engineering, putting it together just to break through a boundary. And so I was on the chief of police elevator. I went through the turnstiles, and I went through the scanner, and I had no identification on me that said I should ever be in that building. So old techniques, just accelerating by technology, can get you really, really far.
And I want to take a second and just imagine that now with the technology we have. So mm-hmm. one of the big scams or hacks that's happening, you may have heard about this Pikeville High School situation where a high school principal's voice was cloned using a tool called 11 Labs. And then there was a very sexist and racist audio tape that was released or audio that was released. Turned out not to be him. Turned out that he was deepfaked. But if you have 99%, you know, 99% of it is all you need, or maybe not even that much, well, imagine how many times you've talked in your voices on the internet, mm-hmm. that your kids' voices are on the internet. So a common thing is to clone a kid's voice, use the information that you have, call, how did you say it, a seasoned saint, you know, and call someone and say, hey, this person needs money because something is going on, or to impersonate a boss calling someone within an organization or office. And I think part of what we're hearing here is that it's not the folks who have the most power often in organizations are the folks who don't realize how powerful they are. Yeah. A lot of times these are folks in administrative positions and roles that have insane access to people and information and data that they don't realize how privileged it is. A lot of these social engineering attacks, they aren't usually going towards an executive or you know, they're usually going around that, you know, that surface area to find easier ways to get into an organization.
One of the things that we did, and I didn't have part of this at DHS, but I worked in the headquarters organization with the CIO and the CISO, and we always had these conversations, well, our team is too smart to fall for that, right? Yeah. And I did not sit into these briefings, but I heard about them, where they would actually take the leadership from all the different components into a room and would show their organization's failure rates on some of the phishing, including the names of either the executives or their very close staff. And that was really eye-opening to them to say that we really are susceptible to this, right? And even though in this one instance, this was a training or this was, you know, a test, how many of those are we not catching? Which was really eye-opening, which really made people say, well, what can we do, right? And so to the example of, you know, the kids or our seasoned seniors, you know, any of those could be circumvented by something that my parents did in the 80s, which was gave us a secret passcode. How many people grew up with a secret passcode, right? And I'll tell you what it is. I use the secret passcode today with my aging parents, the same one that we used for 40-something years, right? Mm-hmm. And that single secret, having something that is, not to get into like PKI and all that type of stuff, which is a whole nerdy thing, but having a shared secret with somebody that you guard very carefully, right? And I think for me, very early on, I didn't understand the concept, but a first principle philosophy was kind of, you know, seeded in me. And I think we need to do that more, like I was saying, as sort of behavioral. We just accept that, you know, there are some times where, stop, hang on a second, do you know this password? You don't? Well, then I'm suspicious. Despite the 99 pieces of true information, right? And so it's again, I truly don't believe this is a technological thing. We do need people to understand deep fakes. We do need people to understand the state of technology and the state of the art, but that moves so quickly. But there are still philosophies and there's still ways of conducting ourselves and conducting business that if we focus more on that aspect, that I think we could circumvent a whole lot more of the technological aspects.
I think that's great. So the training is a huge part of this. And I want to make sure I say this. When we talk about training, we're talking about businesses, but we're also talking about how you train your family and your friends, because just like, you know, an administrative person might be the easiest attack vector, your grandma, your grandpa, and your cousin is your attack vector, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a family sport, even if you don't realize it. And Yolanda, when we were talking during the pre-call, one of the things that you mentioned is that some of this is creating a culture of security. And there are things that we've learned that some of you probably know, like don't pick up a USB drive off the floor and plug it into your computer, right? Or one of the things I know you've said many times, Tina, don't trust the QR codes. Just don't do it, right? Just don't do it. But there's training that's needed here, but also maybe even acceptance about making mistakes so that...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We want to train, and there's so many different things to train on, right? And I think history is a great thing that we should bring up. I'm glad you brought up the safe word because, you know, when they had the grandparents attack, I'm like, oh, come back with the safe word, right? And I used to have it when my daughter was really, really little, and we have that. And then I have to go talk to grandma because grandma, oh my goodness, my mother, every time she goes visit somewhere, she tells everybody, I'm like, do you want to get broken into? and so training and giving examples is really, really, really important. But also when people fall for it, right? And people fall for things. I mean, you know, if I click something because I was tired, I'm like, I'm a cybersecurity professional. What the heck did I just do? You know? And then I lock everything down and call the company. But just like in that quick example, what did you do when you make a mistake? Right? And people need to know the answer to that. And it's okay to say you make a mistake, and it's okay to get like counsel. And so, you know, I had this person that used to go to my church. She's 9 years old. She called me and she's like, I went and got this fancy new phone and I want to turn off the AI. She got an AI phone. And I was like, I'm sorry, you can't turn that off. But this is what we can do to progress forward because she knows she was making mistakes. So it is okay to make mistakes, and we need to give people the path and some resources to what to do, because this part is not changing. Deep fakes are going to be out there. AI is out there. And this is not the last emerging technology, and so more is coming. And so we need to be able to understand our history, but then also to give a way to move forward.
Yeah, and I think some of that, you mentioned this, Joe, which is that sometimes, especially around technology folks, because they think, hey, I can tell the difference between these things, you know, sometimes that makes you blind and more susceptible, which also means that, you know, sometimes you find these folks who are just resistant to say, oops, maybe I did click that email that I shouldn't have, and maybe I should report that instead of, you know, not saying anything, because we, you know, the ramifications are real. And some of that is also about social norms, right? It's okay to say, call me back, you know, for example.
There was I don't want to say hilarious blowback of this in the news this week, where some tech executive, we're all hearing about this agentic AI, right? Mm-hmm. It's not enough just to chat with an AI. We're actually giving it access, like literally access to our computers, giving it keyboard access, giving it access to access the internet on our behalf. There was a huge thing with that earlier. This executive gave an agentic AI access to his computer, his laptop. And it's, and you can read the chat transcripts. And he goes, hey, you know, it'd be really cool. Help me clean up my desktop. And the AI said, okay, I'm going to, I see you've got some pictures over here. I'm going to move them together. And it's literally fingers in his data. And then all of a sudden the AI goes, oops, I have to confess something. When you asked me to move these photos, I didn't just move them. I deleted them. They were his wife's photos from 15 years of photography, if I'm recalling correctly. And they were irretrievable. It did it at a data level. It didn't just like put them in the recycling bin. And so this is what happens when we're plugging these things together, right? We are going to make mistakes as humans, but the more that we rely on technology, the technology is not infallible and it will make mistakes. So we have to set up compartmentalization and firewalls and things like that. Firewalls between, does your lady that goes to your church, she's using a cell phone. Does she need to be doing her banking on that? Or can she continue to do it on a laptop and never connect that phone to your bank? But if you think about your cell phone, how many different parts of your life go through that one single device? If that one single device gets compromised, stolen, or you give an AI bot access to do whatever you want on this device, that little oopsie can become a major, major event, right? So that's where I think it's okay to understand that we're going to make mistakes, but the technology is going to make even bigger mistakes if we allow it. At least the technology did fess up. It was like, hey, and you can read the transcript. Hey, I got something to tell you. My bad.
Yeah. If you want to go down the rabbit hole, there's this thing called MopBot.
I didn't want to get into that.
ClaudeBot. I'm just putting that out there. The AI has created its own social media page, and it's all kinds of things. It's a fun rabbit hole to go down, and but it's a whole nother conversation. There was something that you said, Joel, and also something that you said earlier, Tina, that keeps bringing me back to vibe hacking and vibe coding. There's this great TikTok I was telling someone about earlier. Well, I consider it to be a great TikTok, but the whole idea is about unethical ways to make money. and so this guy decides to create an application, like a Spot Hero. I think he calls it something different. That's a parking app. He vibe codes it with using his Stripe, you know, so it can take transactions. He prints out QR codes, and he just goes and puts those QR codes on top of existing QR codes so people, and he charges $1 extra for parking. And people come and they pay him to park, and he captures all of your personal information that you fill out when you create an account, and he vibe codes this whole thing without knowing a program in like a matter of days using a tool like Lovable. And like, you know, these aren't things that you'd think about, but I mean, I can't tell you how many times Tina's been like, don't scan that QR code. I don't care if you need that menu. But I think you said, like, I don't care what's happening, you're gonna bring me a menu.
Yeah, that is literal. Like I just, you know, I feel like if you've been in the cybersecurity world, you just start thinking like, you know, like, this is what I, you know, could or would do if I were like a nefarious person. But one thing that I do want to highlight in these various examples from the agentic AI to even like the QR codes, et cetera, is convenience. Like that is the, a human nature aspect that makes it extremely difficult. And we see this show up in business a lot as well, right? Like, I mean, the promise of AI is efficiency, is continued speed, is making it easier. The challenge is that it is that very desire or our bent for convenience that makes adversaries' ability to exploit us like that much more, that much easier. When you think about business practices, right? Like, and this is, it's so important to think about this. I had a chance to have a conversation with a senior banking executive, et cetera, and he indicated that he's a CISO, that's the role. and indicated a lot of times, like businesses, the reason why so many attacks are happening and are so successful is because a lot of businesses don't really want to go to the basics, the foundational aspects of business process change, testing things, understanding even what's in your environment, removing things that aren't necessary from a technology perspective. Nobody knows what that server does, but it's been sitting there forever. And if nobody's really watching it, well, that's a great attack vector, right, for an adversary to come in. It's not being checked, but nobody wants to remove it either. Accounts that are there, nobody knows what it does. They're afraid to remove it, right? You think of all these things, and it's like that. I know for my company, Sideploy, I literally had one investor. I appreciated his honesty, so I wouldn't keep, like, you know, talking to him. But he was like, what your tech does, it's boring. It's needed. But it's like, it's the going back to the basics, right? Do you have things configured properly? If you make that change, if you remove that server, if you disable that account, what's the business impact? But somebody has to methodically walk through those sorts of questions. Our tech speeds it up, but nobody wants to take the process, right? And so in talking to this banking exec, he's like, you have to find the companies that have that right will to want to do the right thing from a cybersecurity perspective and not just bring in, you know, slap some other tool on top of bad process, right? And say that, oh, look, we've done our job with cybersecurity. So I think that that's an important thing to remember, is this balance between what we're really fighting against is this, like, just kind of innate bent for convenience. But it is in that realm of wanting convenience that we're finding bad process, immature process, and bad practice.
There's a really funny webcomic that I just saw this week, which is there are 14 different protocols, 14 different ways of getting something done. We have to get together and we have to figure out a way to simplify this. Time passes. There are 15 different ways of making getting this thing done. And it's true, because we don't peel things back. We don't go back to those first principles.
Yeah. And it's important. Like, as you're talking, I'm like, oh my goodness, so many ways that we can definitely attack everything. And we, as humans, trust too much. And I think we overtrust technology. And I grew up seeing, like, how everything that has electricity can be manipulated. And so I never grew up trusting things, but there's a lot of trust in technologies, and technology has more privileges than humans. And I feel that if we kind of, you know, did that audits and we say this entity has access to this much stuff and can touch this many things, should it? I think we would be in a way better place for humanity, right? And then people still don't understand, when we talk about AI, they don't understand AI's has motivations too. We have motivations to make money and hopefully do the right thing and blah, blah, blah. AI has motivations as well that influences the decisions and what information it gives us and what decisions that it takes. And we kind of are forgetting that, right? Right now we have the case studies, right, that people are like, oh, yeah, AI did that, or AI deleted the email, or AI brought an CEO, right, that threatened to cancel the AI service. And these are great use cases, right? But the more that we put it out there, it's going to become really scarier.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, someone threatened the AI, said it was going to shut it off, and yes, the AI push back.
The AI looked through the emails, yes, found blackmail material, and said, if you try to shut me off, I will tell so-and-so about such-and-such.
Yeah. Yep.
Because it had access to all the emails and the servers. And so, and the CEO wanted to cut off the AI because it did not think that it was adding value to the company.
Mind you, this was a test.
It was.
So just to be clear, this was a simulation that was done by the AI companies to start sussing this out. So the companies are trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. The companies are trying to find these little gaps. But again, how many don't they know about? Because we have black boxes, because we have you know, these systems that are, you know, as we get towards this concept of AGI, right, or the general AGI,
AGI,
yeah, or for general intelligence.
Artificial general intelligence.
You know, it's the everything box. It's really hard to control and understand what's happening inside an everything box.
Yeah.
So we just have to be skeptical. I'll share really briefly. My wife is a logistics and supply chain person for an electronics manufacturer. So she basically, her company, the supply chain is run in SAP, where all the data is, Excel, and my wife's brain, because she knows where all the pieces are. And her company is testing out all these tools. Well, can we get Claude to come in and replace some of this? And she's like, number one, that's a language model. I'm a numbers person. She deals with numbers. She deals with statistical data, right? So we need to be skeptical of, again, the everything box. Thinking just because I can talk to something and it seems like it has a semblance of understanding, it doesn't, right? But there are phenomenal uses of AI. I feel like we're getting kind of doomerist up here a little bit. There are phenomenal uses of specifically designed, specifically trained, purposeful AI. And it's not all language models, right? Mm-hmm. So we do want to understand that too. But all of them come with caveats. All of them come with, you have to understand before you adopt. Mm-hmm. And then you have to not go into it, trust but verify. You have to be skeptical, right?
So, if I remember correctly, the story, too, if you guys are interested in doing some reading afterwards, is about this thing called Claudius. And it's a very awesome story. It's a test or a research project to see if an AI can run a vending machine business. And it ultimately tries to blackmail someone. So really good story. Now, you said something, Joe, that's probably important. Let's not be the doom, the world is ending. So, like, what do you do about this, right? So there's a lot of things that are happening, and I'm going to ask a question in a minute. But there's, of course, detection and verification. That's one of the roads that's happening. Now, this is contentious right now. There are stories of high school and college kids who are being caught using AI. But sometimes it's not AI because it's hard to really verify what's AI. There are questions about artwork or things that have been created because AI was used as part of the creation, but not necessarily for the end result. And so there's these questions about, all right, well, we're going to have tools to verify things on the internet, but what does that mean? There's also, you know, some other thoughts that are out there in terms of best practices that I'm hoping to hear from you. Joe, you've already mentioned zero trust. There's also this idea of least level of access, least level permissions, and some best practices that we could probably start to think of in the way that we interact with the world and technology to just make sure we're safeguarding ourselves. I don't know who wants to take a crack at what do we do? How do we protect ourselves?
I'm starting to have this thought about data, right? Like AI doesn't run without data. And so how do we protect our data? And then how do we put it in different compartments? And how do we trust the data? And then I think retention should be looked at as well. And so why do I say that? We went to this era of put everything that was in different databases all into the cloud. And then now we're good. And why are we good? Because we trust the cloud, because we trust the cloud companies. And we also have cybersecurity insurance if anything goes wrong. And that's another topic we can talk about too, right? They don't really pay out because there's so many caveats. But we have a whole lot of trust that. But put on the bad side, this is a gold mine to put all your data, everything into the cloud without partitions. And if you put in a partition, I just have to defeat it, right? And then guardrails is a new challenge. People are really motivated to beat the guardrails. And so, and making a lot of money going after beating guardrails. So what if we, you know, crazy thing, what if we don't put all our data together? And what kind of world could we create? So it's a question.
I think you pointed out something interesting, which is industries upon industries upon industries, mm-hmm. right? So we have to put all of our information in the cloud, So now we have to spin up industries about how do we understand and protect what's in the cloud. All right, so now we're going to build these AIs that can access all that information and that can pull all the information together and do contextualization. Oh, no, now we now have to have these industries and these technologies that will tell whether the thing that you're reading and that you spit out is AI, right? So and this is standard, typical IT stuff. Yep. We've been doing it for many, many years. What I think we need to be skeptical of are the gold miners and the people who do the rushing, right? We all know that the people who made money in the gold rush were the ones selling the picks and the shovels, right? It's these little industries that pop up around. You see the people who show up on LinkedIn and they go, do you know how you can tell whether something was written by AI? Because it uses the M dash. Well, as a copywriter by trade, do you know why the AI uses the M dash? Because that's the correct punctuation when you're using when you're writing business stuff. But we just sort of, we've trained these AIs on the way things should be done, and then we become skeptical of that. So I kind of feel like these industries, we need to flatten and break down a little bit, go back to those first principles, peel things back. Do we really need all the data together and accessible? Should we, you know, we should trust experts when they tell us how to detect AI, but we should be skeptical of that expert and make them prove their expertise. There are digital footprinting ways, fingerprinting ways to tell whether a piece of digital media has been manipulated. Every time you see something pop up on the news, right, a legitimate news source, you can be darn sure that they've had forensics analysis on that piece of media before it ever hit the airwaves, because they want to make sure that you can trust them as a source. But the people who just throw up randomly and say, oh, trust this thing because you can see it with your eyes without any type of expert scrutiny on it, you know, you need to be skeptical of that. So it's a real balance between who do we trust, what do we build systems around, and then where do we just, like, trust with our gut?
I think in the way of solution one, I think just a baseline one is for us to just mentally remember that AI is a program. So Yolanda talked about the data. I think we have to remember that it is a program. It is written by someone. It is trained on the data that exists today. Like, it is not this all-seeing, all-knowing, right, being, right? It is not a, you know, a demigod or anything like that, right? It is a program, and it is trained on existing data and knowledge. Yes, certainly a very smart program, et cetera, but I think it's very important just to kind of keep that, like, from a solution perspective and how we use it and how we rely on it and what we allow it to have access to. Like, this is a program. We talk about intent and, you know, things like that. Like, somebody, as they're writing things, it is trained in a certain way. Joel mentioned the word trained. Like, you're in essence, like, think of it, you know, the way we have, like, a child, whoever that child's parents are, it is like that child is influenced by the values, the direction, the thoughts, the prejudices, and everything. So that's one solution in how we're using it. The other one, just on, you know, not getting into, like, political aspects, but we really do need to be involved in the conversations that are happening about AI, how it can be used, the industries and sectors that it can be used in, the kinds of decisions. This is not a neutral, AI is not neutral. Like, it has an agenda. Like, you have to keep that in mind, no matter, you know, whatever way we try to frame it. It's important that we're keeping track of this and paying attention on a local, state, and national level, in terms of the decisions and the industries and the ways in which AI is allowed to be used. It is not some neutral program. We have to remember that in our businesses, in our families, in our personal lives. There's a lot, it's very powerful, yes, but as a part of the solution, like, we need to keep in mind what AI actually is. Another solution that I would say is just going back to solid business practice, especially from a cybersecurity perspective. AI is just an amplifier of either good or bad, depending depending upon how you use it in your organization. So it's important to really get back and make sure, like, from a fundamentals perspective, we're looking at how we conduct business, like really understanding what the process actually is. Can somebody in your organization, and how mature is it? When we think about like risk and risk maturity, a part of risk management maturity is how well various levels of your organization know and understand what's going on, what's the appropriate process, et cetera, right? Like, it's still important to understand and know what your actual business processes are, how to respond to things. So don't skip over process. AI only accelerates the way in which things can happen, but don't skip any steps. You can take the steps faster with AI, but don't skip any steps. So when you think about like a business process perspective, the fundamentals still need to be in place. So I'll stop there with solutions.
All right. You heard it here. Thank you all for attending. Thank you to this great panel. You guys have been awesome. And also thank you, World Trade Center Institute, for putting this on. And, of course, all of you all for attending.